Our friend and contributor David Lee has had a rich, award-winning career in culinary writing, but it turns out he wasn't always excited about food. For him, food has also long been tied up with his struggles with his weight, complicated family life, sexuality, and mental illness, until he realized that feeding and being fed by his partner could bring him back to his roots. Our contributor Shauna Seaver talked with David about his revealing new book, Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression.
Hello, David Leet.
Hello, Shauna.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Now, like a lot of people, I knew of your work initially from the food world. And so when I first picked up this book, I think maybe I was expecting more of a traditional food memoir. But this is not that. There are so many more themes intertwined. Now, you begin the book talking about your early childhood memories growing up in Fall River, Massachusetts, as part of a big Portuguese family. Can you tell us a little about the family dynamic and the role that food played in your family?
Sure. I was born in 1960, so this was the 60s, and it was in one house. We called it a tenement. A tenement back then was a three-story house that was three apartments, and we had a nice big yard, and there was a vegetable garden in back. And it was my mother, my father, myself on the second floor, and my godmother, my godfather, and my cousin Barry on the first floor in the front. On the first floor in back was my grandmother and my grandfather. And there were tons of cousins and all these relations that would always come over. So there was always very kind of raucous meals that we would have. My mother and my father and I would have our meals, you know, our dinners. But on Sundays, we'd all be together. So there'd be 9, 10, 12, 15 people all together. And sometimes the dinners would take place outside in the yard because there wasn't any room. And it was always raucous. And of course, there was tons and tons of Portuguese food being served. There was codfish and rice and sausages and all different foods that we had. But for me, from a very early age, I didn't want to eat Portuguese food. I didn't see anything about Portuguese people on television. I didn't see us being represented anywhere. So I internalized this notion of Portuguese as sort of being bad and Portuguese as not being American. So all I wanted growing up was I just wanted American food. I wanted Betty Crocker cakes with Betty Crocker frosting and anything you saw on television, Spam, Velveeta. Those are the things that I desperately wanted. So I turned my nose up at a lot of foods when I was younger.
Now, you do mention that in the book and calling it wanting to be American by consumption.
Yes.
And you mentioned some of these foods that gave you that feeling growing up. But why do you feel it was so important to you to separate yourself from your heritage in this way through food?
When I was very young, I don't understand why, but there seemed to be a lot of prejudice against the Portuguese coming over. And I don't understand why, because there were so many Portuguese living there. Maybe the Portuguese were the newest people and on the lowest rung, and therefore they were being picked on. But they would say really horrible things like Portuguese. And like a Portuguese is a really, to me, a very insulting phrase, or pork chop. And so I saw the venom with which these invectives were spewed out at my father and at my mother and at our family and other families, too, that are Portuguese. And so I just internalized that there was something wrong with us. And up to that point, I didn't know anything but Portuguese. And so that was like the first inkling that there was something different about us. And that embarrassed me.
Later on in the book, we learn about your challenges with mental illness for pretty much your entire life.
Yeah.
And your struggles with your sexuality for a number of years, your battles with weight and self-image. And through it all, it seems that food was both your savior and a source of great anxiety for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Food played many different roles. In the beginning, it was my nemesis. I wanted to get away from it. I wanted, like I said, all this American food that I saw on television. And when some of the mental illness started showing its face, I was having a lot of anxiety in my early 11, 12 years old. I started having panic attacks. And food was very comforting. And I would eat anything that was given to me. My grandmother and my mother would make anything. And I would eat Portuguese food, American food, anything that was put on the table because it was comfort for me. And then I went through a period where I lost a lot of weight. And I was down to 169, but I told everyone 170 because that 1 pound secret for me was like the most amazing thing to know that I actually had a six in my weight, 169. And so it became the enemy again. And I would not eat. I really chose not to eat. I ate very little. And it was very difficult to embrace food. And then I met the one who in the book everyone now finds out is Alan. And he kind of turned my head around about food. And then I slowly began eating. And then I slowly began eating more and more. And I got into the food world and ate more and more and more. And so I became the 180-degree opposite of what I was when I met Alan and became very overweight, which is what I'm struggling with now.
Food seems to be kind of a way to employ all of our senses. We all know that it can equally be stimulating, it can be distracting, it can be about connection. What of those things, or maybe all of those things, do you feel either helped or made your mental illness more difficult?
Well, one of the things that food, and specifically the act of cooking food, did for me was it calmed me, it centered me, it gave me a point of focus. I say in the book that if sometimes just watching butter slump in the pan as it was melting just calmed me and it gave me a sense of purpose. And so in a lot of ways, food, it's another role that food played in my life as healer. It healed me, not just from consuming it and feeling better and such, but just the act of preparing it for others. And a lot of times I would cook and sometimes not even eat, but it was just knowing that I was in the kitchen and I could take these disparate ingredients and put something together, especially with baking. I love baking. And please others somehow gave me a lift, just a bit sometimes, but it would give me a lift. And in that, you were talking about the different senses and how sensate it is and how sensual food is. All of that played a role too. And I would get lost in those smells and the sights and the tastes of it. And it'd be a diversion momentarily. And sometimes that's all it took to get through the day.
Now, in your mid-30s, you mentioned you meet your partner, Alan, who you call the One. He is still your One.
He's still my One. He's still there.
He's still your One.
Almost 24 years, yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. And food does play quite a role in your relationship, although I found it very interesting that his food experience with his family growing up was very different from yours. Tell us about that.
Yeah, growing up for him, food was his table. When he sat down with his stepfather and his mother, was always fraught with a lot of emotion. There was a lot of anger. His stepfather was a very difficult person, and I didn't know this for quite a while. And then he revealed that to me, and I was very surprised because he didn't seem to be scarred by that, as a lot of people would. But what came out of that? Because he was always trying to duck out of the table. So as soon as he was done, he would just like slink away so he wouldn't be seen by his stepfather. What that did was cause him to become a diner. He is a diner. And I come from a family of eaters. We eat. We are raucous. We are loud. We eat. 10 minutes after we're done, all the women in our family would clean up the table, and there was no sign that we ever had a meal. All the men were in the backyard sitting on folding chairs waiting for the next meal, and the kids were out in the street playing, getting hungry for the next meal. That's what we did. We just ate meal to meal to meal.
That sounds familiar to me, yes.
And then Alan comes along, and very early on I realized we had to dine. And at that point, I was still young, thin, and beautiful. And so I was eating nothing for dinner except either some pasta with low-calorie sauce or Fiber One cereal. But he had to light candles. He had to play music. It had to be china on the table. I had to get my – couldn't have the cereal box in front of me and read the back of it like I did when I was a kid. It had to be poured into the bowl. Milk had to be poured in. And we sat and we talked. And when we were done, he would push away and he would expect us to continue talking. And I'm like, what? We're going to sit at the table and continue talking? I have things to do. I have a life. But that's not how he wanted his life to be based upon what his childhood was. So we had a lot of grappling of this diner versus eater. for the early parts of our relationship.
And now you cook and bake for each other pretty often, calling it love food.
Love food, yeah. That's the name we gave the food very early on when we got together, because we decided to cook for each other. And he had a dish which was, it was roast pork with apples. And I made a apple sour cream pie. And it was our first major meal that we did together. We made for each other. And from that repetition of that meal, which we made every Sunday for many, many weeks, and then we started adding other things to it, came our very first tradition as a couple, which was Sunday supper, which we still have.
Now, there's a very powerful scene in the book I'd love for you to tell us about, where you talk about Alan making a certain cake for you that really unearths some strong memories.
Yes, that, like I said, that is my young, thin, and beautiful time. And he decided to make, it was, I believe, a pineapple upside-down cake. And he said, hey, do you want to lick the bowl? And when I took a swipe of the batter and I tasted it, there was this Proustian moment that hurtled me back to my childhood. And I didn't know where. I couldn't place this taste. And then I even picked up the bowl and smelled it. And the smell of the butter and the smell of the flour all mixed together was so familiar. But I had never really baked. And he had never baked for me before, so it wasn't something in our relationship. And I called my mom and I said, Mom, did you ever bake? And I knew the answer. And she's like, come on, Banana, you know that I don't bake. And she says, but Vovó did. Vovó is grandmother in Portuguese. She said, Vovó did. And I'm like, she did? She goes, don't you remember? She used to pull up the chair to the stove and you would stand on the chair and you would cook and bake together. And these memories that I had forgotten, I was about 34 years old, I had forgotten, just came flooding back to me. And a door was pried open to my past. And all of that pushing down my Portuguese heritage, pushing down anything that had to do with my family and food, just popped open with that smell and that taste of that cake batter. And I was enrolled in a baking class, I think, 2 weeks later.
And it was such a small thing that really changed the course of your life, this waking up to realizing that you had positive food memories. And at that point in the book, it really does start to almost have kind of a domino effect, I felt, when I was reading it. And you take this trip to Portugal with the one who has you go to your grandmother's house or the house where your grandmother used to live. And please tell us about the story of this hidden oven.
Sure.
I just love this story.
My family, both sides of my family, is from the island of San Miguel in the Azores, which are nine islands about 1,000 miles off the coast of Portugal. And we had gone there to San Miguel, to the town of Maia, which is where my father's family is from. And I had heard about this house since I was a kid. Dirt floors, rough stone walls, an oven, a wall oven, the pigsty in the back. And then beyond that was the outhouse where the chickens would peck your butt when you did your business, and very rustic, very rural. And so I wanted to see the house. And it was at that point owned by a cousin of my grandfather, my father's father. So we went, knocked on the door unannounced. And I said in Portuguese, I'm David Leet, the son of Emmanuel and Elvira Leet. And the woman looked at me, and then there was this, "Hi, David." And she like hugs me, and she just took my head and like brought it all the way down to her bosom, and she's about 4 feet tall, so I was like bent way over. And she had us come in, but when I walked in, it was a very different house. It was this beautiful flooring, and there was this huge screen television. And in the kitchen, it was all yellow appliances. It was just a modern kitchen. And this woman, Elvira, had two daughters who spoke English, and I said, is the oven still there, the wall oven? And I had heard about stories of how my grandmother, Leet, Vovó Leet, would cook in there, and also that's where they got some of their heat. And there's this wonderful tradition in the neighborhood where my grandmother would bake bread, let's say on a Monday, and then someone else's mother would bake it on a Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. So when you ran out, you went to the person who baked that day to get a loaf of bread, and you would return that when it was your turn. And I'd heard all these stories, and so Elvira said, I sing, and she asked Alan and me to move the stove forward and then move this big metal plate behind the stove away. And there was
There was the stove. There was the brick oven, the wall oven. And it was an astounding moment for me because I connected with my family in a way that I had never did before. And I say that if roots could have come out of my feet and burrowed their way into the volcanic soil of that island, they would have, because I finally felt that I was where I belonged. And it was an extraordinarily powerful moment for me.
Well, I, for one, am so glad that this moment happened, because that led you to your food writing career, which then led you to writing this book, which mm-hmm. is really extraordinary. And I love talking with you about it. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you for having me.
David Leet's new book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. Shauna Seaver's latest book is Real Sweet. You can find David's recipe for one of his family favorites, Azorian kale and bean soup, at splendidtable.org.